Welcome to the Inside Light podcast, a space for healing, self-connection, and all things spiritual. I'm Terry, also known in the sober world as Sassy Sober Mum, and I believe that within each of us lives a guiding light, a quiet, powerful presence that always knows the way. Here, we'll explore the many paths back to that light. Together, we'll dive into stories of healing, practices that bring us home to ourselves, and conversations about awakening. Those moments when we remember who we truly are. Whether you're seeking clarity, courage, or simply a reminder that you are not alone on your journey of life, this podcast is here to hold space for you. Because the light inside you has never gone out. It's always been guiding you, waiting for you to come back home. This is the Inside Light podcast. Let's begin. Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. I have just taken in my youngest daughter. It's her first day of school today. So it's been a good morning, but a bit of an emotional morning because we have been building up to this for what feels like months and months and months now. And there's been a lot of anxiety around her starting school. My youngest is definitely autistic, but I suspect that she is ADHD like me, which is autistic and ADHD. And that's the reason for this episode today, is to talk about ADHD, about my experience with what I would say undiagnosed ADHD, because I only really understood that I was autistic ADHD last year, when I was in my 46 year of life. So, you know, I've come to the ADHD party very, very late. And I'm seeing this is a growing trend. I'm seeing a lot of people, women especially, are getting to sort of 30s, 40s, or, you know, especially around those perimenopause years. And especially actually in the sober community, there is a growing link between ADHD or autism or ADHD and high dopamine activities like drinking. But not just that, I think there's a lot more information around autism, ADHD. There's an explosion of it on social media, and it's coming out of the shadows. And this means that more and more people are finding information accessible. More and more people are finding relatable content. They might watch something on social media or read something and think, you know what? That's a bit like me. I relate to that. I resonate with that. And so I wanted to talk through my journey with discovering that I was ADHD and how I feel about it now and how I kind of manage it, I suppose, and also how I cope as a parent that is ADHD with three ADHD children, three ADHD daughters, which has been a very, very challenging journey. So I wanted to share it because when I found out that I was autistic ADHD, I didn't find a lot of content that really related directly to me, and I was very, very desperate for it in the early days. I couldn't actually even find very much about ADHD at all. It's becoming more widely recognized now, but it's still very, very, I think, misunderstood, underdiagnosed. I think that there are a lot of complexities when diagnosing autism and ADHD because they're such conflicting neurotypes. And you know, that creates a dichotomy. And I think that there needs to be a lot more people that are neuroaffirming. So what I mean by that is that they have direct experience of neurodivergence, either because they are neurodivergent, ideally, or they have neurodivergence in their family and direct experience, perhaps with children. And so they really understand the fibers of that, of those neurotypes, and they come to assessments with a deeper understanding. It's not just a textbook understanding, because ADHD is complicated to diagnose, and I have really understood that, finding it challenging to get my own diagnosis. Fortunately, now I'm over a year into understanding about my neurotype, and I've done a huge amount of research. I've read a huge number of books. I've listened to a lot of hours of podcasts. And I've also got three children that are ADHD. So I feel like I am much more of an expert now in my own neurodivergence and that of my family. But I also really recognize how challenging it is to identify it in yourself, or then seek and get a formal diagnosis. So I'll take you back to how it all started for us as a family, really, because my eldest daughter is the key that unlocks this door for all of us, really. So just over a year ago, my eldest daughter was having a lot of meltdowns. So, you know, a lot of instances where she wasn't coping, she wasn't able to manage her emotions in a way that I guess, you know, you might expect a child to be able to manage them. I mean, now I realize that, you know, there is no one size fits all. But back then I didn't know any better. And I started to notice that having big meltdowns at 9 and 10, you know, felt a bit unusual, because, you know, there is that tendency to think, well, you know, she should be growing out of this now. And there was also a sensory element happening as well. So whenever it would rain, my daughter would get scared and would wake up in the night and would need to come and sleep in my room on the floor or in the bed. And, you know, this, the wind and the rain and very loud noises, you know, sometimes in situations where the noise levels would be quite big, so things like concerts and the circus, for example, you know, I started to join the dots on, she didn't cope very well with things like fireworks and big sounds. We often used to have an air show, because I'm based on the south coast in Dorset, and it was a big there used to be a big air show that happened every year. And when she was little, I remember she couldn't cope with the jets. She used to have to buy those ear defenders so that she would not feel scared of that big noise. And I went for dinner with a really good friend, and that friend had said to me that her daughter, who was 21, 22, had just been diagnosed autistic. And so we started to sort of compare notes, and I'd had a bit of an inkling, I felt like there was something going on with my daughter, but I just didn't really know what. I didn't have the understanding or the language to interpret it in a way that really kind of made sense or that filled me with confidence. And when I mentioned about the sensory thing to her, she said, "Oh yeah, my daughter used to do that too. You know, in fact, she used to make a camp in the bedroom, and she would be under, you know, sometimes she would be in the wardrobes, you know, trying to shut herself away from that sound." And so something in me kind of nudged in that conversation. It was like, oh, okay, so she's just been diagnosed autistic. My daughter is displaying some similar kind of behaviors. Maybe maybe my daughter's autistic too. That might make sense. And so that was the first time that I thought, maybe there's something that we need to explore. Anyway, about a month later, she started year six, and the meltdowns were continuing. If anything, they were getting worse at the end of the day and when she came home from school. And we started to connect with the school and say, look, she needs some, needs some fidget toys. There were some things that were coming up about her experience of school, which up until this point had been absolutely, almost, you would call it perfect. She was almost like the perfect student, always just going in, never, didn't have low attendance, never had any issues with that, always seemed to thrive, really. That's, there were issues with friendship. So that was something that had come up the year before, that there were some friendship dynamics that weren't working very well for her. Again, with hindsight, we realized that there were probably some social challenges for her that we weren't aware of. But there was some falling out of friends, and that was quite difficult. And so anyway, about a month into her year six journey, she suddenly went into burnout and she couldn't go back to school. She just literally, we would drive her to school. She would be crying in the car, having a meltdown in the car, just refusing to get out, wouldn't go into the school ground. And it all happened, it felt like, overnight. The wheels just sort of came off overnight. And so that she'd already had by that point, sorry, I forgot to mention, we had already had her assessed and she had been diagnosed autistic. So we knew that kind of 6 or 7 months before she started this year six journey, we knew that that was, that she was autistic, that was her neurotype. And so we had made some adjustments and we'd talked to the school and we tried to make some accommodations, but she seemed okay. But this starting of year six, and I think probably the pressure and the ramping up, and also she had recently also been diagnosed as slow processing. So she was struggling to keep up with work, with concepts. She was probably feeling quite a lot of pressure, feeling embarrassed that she couldn't keep up with friends. She was already having some help and support, tutor support already. She'd been having that quite a lot at her dad's house in the years kind of leading up to this. So she was sort of probably just about keeping her head above water, really. But then this starting of year six, she just went straight into burnout. And burnout was a very scary thing, having a 10-year-old going into burnout is very, very scary. It's not like anything I'd ever experienced before as a parent. I didn't know any other parents that were going through this. It really felt like we'd just been thrown into totally uncharted waters. It was very, very scary. And in the meantime, she was in a very burnt out state. So she wasn't really coping. She was locking herself in her room, in a dark room, just watching YouTube, wanted food being sent up to her. She couldn't cope with a lot of conversations. She couldn't cope with any demands that she'd been used to. So any kind of like, come and sit at the table, have dinner, let's go and do this, let's do that, let's go here. She just couldn't cope with any of that stuff. Everything pushed her into fight or flight, like very dramatic reactions to any kind of basic requests that as a family we'd been used to dishing out, to be honest, for years and years and years without any issue, or what we thought was any issue anyway. So anyway, I started reading. That's how I learn. That's how I cope. I have to learn about what's going on and try to make sense of it. I started reading and I read a book called Low Demand Parenting by Amanda Diekman. Real game changing book, actually. She talks a lot in her book about the PDA profile, which is a pressure sensitive profile of autism, which basically is a nervous system disorder where the PDA can't cope with any kinds of demands. not just external demands, like demands from mum or school or friends, you know, do this, do that, whatever, but even internal demands. So, you know, a demand that she might have herself, which is, I really want to do this thing, that can create a complex reaction internally as well. So it's internal and external demands. But it's a nervous system disorder, right? So the demand creates a spike in adrenaline, cortisol, and that perceived loss of autonomy, so feeling out of control or losing control, or the perception that there's no control, can send into fight, flight, or freeze. But my experience, or our experience, has been very much fight and flight with her, not a lot of freeze. And so we had this period of 2 or 3 months where it was just chaos at home. Things were getting broken. She was running out the door and running away in her nightie. The police would turn up, and it was just chaotic. We didn't know whether we were coming or going. We were in complete crisis mode. It was just so difficult. I had to take 2 weeks off work. I went into burnout. I hit rock bottom. This was all 2 or so months before my own spiritual awakening, which I now feel like that is quite heavily linked to my spiritual awakening, hitting this kind of rock bottom, or what some people in the spiritual world might call this dark night of the soul. And yeah, just thinking, I don't know how to get myself out of this. You know, I've had a challenging life, and I've dealt with a lot, but this is something that I feel is out of my, you know, control, and I don't know how to cope with this. So I had a period of time where I think I just cried every day, because I just didn't know how to deal with it. And the school were obviously, understandably, on my case. They were coming up with suggestions like, you know, well-meaning suggestions like, can we try and get her to come early into the school? Can we get her to sit on a Zoom with her friends from school? Can we get her to just wake up and put her uniform on? And all of these things that, you know, they were so unfortunately disconnected from our real life experience. And there was no way, we couldn't even get her to come out of her room and eat downstairs. There was just absolutely no way that we were gonna get her to comply with any of these sorts of things. And I started to go on a bit of a journey of feeling quite frustrated about the school system, not about our school in particular, because, you know, they were definitely trying to help, and, you know, that was obvious. And it's not about kind of finger pointing and blame, but it just became very clear to me that this, you know, kind of one size fits all approach to school, my child very much sat outside of that. And that was quite difficult to understand and then accept, that I could see quite clearly in the months following the burnout that there was probably very little chance that my daughter was going to be able to cope in any kind of formal school environment again. And what did that mean for us as a family? What did that mean for her? What did that mean for my other children? What did that mean for my job? You know, you have to consider everything in that situation. And whilst I am very open to unschooling, which is actually what we're doing now, but unschooling and homeschooling and all of those sorts of things, I'm not particularly great with having children around me all day, every day. I mean, I as part of my own understanding of my own neurotype, is that actually, whilst my ADHD might be very sociable or be very high masking, my autistic side really craves time on my own, routine, structure, and being able to sit in quiet and do my work. So, you know, having a child not in a school environment, you know, really kind of threw my stability off as well. And it was something that I'm still having to learn how to cope with. So that's the story with my daughter. But we realized that this PDA thing was becoming more and more of an obvious facet, if you like, of her autistic neurotype. So we actually managed to find a specialist, because unfortunately PDA is not recognized by the NHS. It's not part of the DSM-5, which is the official assessment criteria for things like autism and ADHD. And so there, and actually, even once we'd even had a diagnosis, we had to go privately for that diagnosis, but we did get the diagnosis. In fact, we not only got the diagnosis for PDA, but we also got the diagnosis for ADHD. So my eldest daughter is ADHD, diagnosed, and PDA. But even the school, when we were trying to sort an EHCP document out to help her, you know, in school, if she was going to go back to school, which now she's not, but even they wouldn't acknowledge PDA. They refused to include it as part of the EHCP, which is crazy, really, because PDA is very, I think, completely different, really, from, you know, the way that you might approach autism in a school is not the right way for a PDAer. You need a completely different approach for a PDAer. Having PDA in focus is probably the most important out of the whole three, because it requires the most collaboration. It requires the most understanding and compassion. And so it's kind of frustrating, really, that we live in a time where that's not officially recognized, because what I have seen is there are a lot of PDAs out there in the world. There are a lot of children that are struggling. There are a lot of people that are not able to attend school and that are unschooling. And that's because we don't have any other options, unfortunately. PDA is 70% of PDA is officially, based on the PDA.org website, 70% are out of school. They cannot cope with school. And so that pushes parents like me, of children like my daughter, out of the school system and feeling like we have no other option. In an ideal world, we'd have some flexi schooling, but that's not available right now. Maybe that will be part of the future. I hope it is. I'm sure it will be, as the school system changes, because it needs to change to accommodate all different types of children. So alongside this, there's my other daughter, my middle daughter, who I could tell was definitely ADHD, but I also then started to notice, whilst I'd been on my own journey alongside all this going off with my eldest daughter, I noticed that my middle daughter might also be autistic too. And I had had a private ADHD diagnosis, but I had become very aware of the fact that not everything felt like it fit in the ADHD bucket. So, you know, there were lots of questions in my ADHD assessment that were hard no's. So, for example, you know, things like, do you struggle to finish tasks? Well, sometimes, yes, but also sometimes, no. Do you struggle to see projects to completion? Sometimes, yes, but more often, no. You know, I managed to get a lot of projects across the line. You know, for example, my podcast, my other podcast, my Sober Stories from Everyday People podcast, I had the idea to have that podcast in, you know, on a day, and my ADHD not only like thought of the idea, started working on it straight away, and the dopamine of getting that podcast like up and running, buying the music, working out on YouTube how to format my own podcast, like literally learning everything within about a 48-hour period. And, you know, by the end of that, I had that podcast, by the end of that week, that podcast was out into the world. I recorded one episode, my own story with drinking, and then done. That was it. Edited out the door. So, you know, I know that the ADHD part of me would have got a lot of dopamine from getting the idea, thinking about it, sourcing the music. But quite commonly with ADHD, it might then either not quite get finished, or it might get finished, but one or two episodes in, it might have run its course. The dopamine has already been extracted from that process, and so therefore it's not interesting enough to maintain it. However, that's when my autism, team autism, who's in the back seat for me, comes into focus and keeps that going. And I've got 111 episodes out now. And even though my time is very restricted with all the different things that I'm doing, I'm still managing to make time and to push those episodes out. So, you know, there were examples where I definitely ticked a lot of the more kind of typical ADHD boxes. You know, sometimes I can, sometimes things can be a bit disorganized, but then there were examples of where I was hugely organized, like organized on a different level. Like, so for example, I have a budget spreadsheet for my life where it has every single day, it has information for about the next 10 years of my life. So I go into Excel and I can scroll all the way down to like in 5 years time, and I could tell you roughly the prediction of what I'd have in my savings and in my bank account on like the 13th of May, 2030. I mean, that's how, when that's not typical ADHD behavior, right? That's what you would probably call much more typical autistic behavior. Having that deep, granular level of detail for numbers, you know, my finances for 10 years, for the next 10 years. And I go into that spreadsheet every single day, pretty much, apart from weekends. I go into that spreadsheet and I manage my finances pretty much every day. Like, I'm very, very committed to that. So I think I started to notice that in the assessment process, yes, there were lots of things that resonated with ADHD. I literally lose my phone 5 times a day in my house. I've left my phone in shops, on floors. I mean, keys, phones, you know, purses, all of those kinds of things. I can lose them 100 times a day. I've got Apple AirTags on everything, on bags, on my key rings. Obviously, I've got my phone. I've got an Apple. I've got an iPhone and an Apple Watch, and they ping each other. And I've got Find My iPhone. I've got all those sorts of things set up because I regularly lose AirPods and, you know, put my keys down and don't know where things are. So, you know, those cognitive limitations I very much suffer from with my ADHD. And I overshare very ADHD behavior. You know, I'm a massive oversharer, and I'll meet you, and within 10 minutes, you'll probably know everything about all the ups and downs in my life. You know, I'm a huge oversharer. I butt into conversations. I have to try so hard, especially on my podcast, not to butt into people that I'm talking to. It's such an effort. But I've had that all my life. Like, I've butt into people's conversations all my life. Sometimes used to finish off people's sentences. Again, quite ADHD behavior. And being very kind of extrovert, chatty, outgoing. You know, when I got diagnosed with ADHD, most of my friends said, not surprised. I'm absolutely not surprised. However, there were other things as well. You know, there was a difficulty in maintaining eye contact. And I've always had weird eye contact, to be honest. In fact, I struggle so much to give people my eye contact. And I even tell myself when I'm talking to people, give people eye contact, give people eye contact, give people eye contact. You know, so that's a real effort for me. I deep dive topics. So hyper-focusing is a very ADHD thing, but it kind of can quite often be short-term, right? So hyper-focusing, you know, might be, oh, I want to take up tennis, go out, buy all the tennis gear, book all the tennis lessons, get really excited about the idea of it. It's really good. Maybe do a lesson, do two lessons, and then, it's gone. And I've done that. I've had many, many hobbies and things that I've got into, and then they're dead to me, you know, like I've dropped them like a ton of bricks. But then there is, in autism, something called special interest, which is like a sustained focus on a particular thing. So, and I very much have that too, right? So I have a special interest in psychology and in human behavior and in neuroscience and in self-help. And I've been fascinated by this since my mid-20s, and I'm still utterly obsessed with reading information and reading books that people have written about these subjects. I never read fiction. I always read non-fiction, and quite often it is linked to my special interest, which is psychology and about the brain. And that's quite common, actually. Autistic people can often be interested in those kinds of topics, because it's almost like, you know, there is a mimicking with autism. There is a trying to understand how to fit into the world. And I think that on some subconscious level, getting into psychology and how the brain works and human behavior, it's like you're sort of trying to learn how to be in the world. So anyway, I have a very, very deep fascination with that. But I have lots of, you know, I have lots of kind of special interests that, and I make things special interests. So for example, when I got my first electric car, I've gone back now to a diesel car, but I had an electric car. I almost learned the whole handbook off by heart. And when people asked me about the electric car, it was like an absolute free-for-all opportunity to be able to regurgitate all of these facts and how long the range was and how it compared to this and that in that test. And that, it's like my husband would, you know, before my husband knew about my ADHD autism, he would just be like, you are so boring. Like, will you stop boring people with your electric car knowledge? I mean, I laugh about it now, because I didn't realize that, you know, I was autistic, and that, you know, that kind of not being able to read the room, I'd struggle to pull those conversations back in. You know, I'd struggle to be able to identify when people had got a bit bored of the sort of like 25 facts that I was sharing. So, you know, that was another thing. Also, one of the big things, and to be honest, this actually can be something that it is in both camps, if you like, but it's blunt communication. I'm a very direct communicator. It is my natural communication style to just tell you to do, you know, do that thing now. I'm not great at dressing things up. I'm not very good at, oh, if you wouldn't mind and you had a spare moment in your day, would you be, I just haven't got that in me. You know, for me, it's like, can you come at 6 and do this thing? You know, so people will interpret that as quite rude. And you know, it's a difficult one, right? Because the intention is never rudeness. And so then you get into this situation, and I've had this discussion many times with my husband, because my husband, he's the one that really, I suppose, is mostly exposed to this. That my husband and my children are mostly exposed to my direct, sometimes slightly barky tone. And I do understand that that can be frustrating. But equally, I'm in a place where I'm trying to unmask, you know, I'm trying to not have to change and adjust to make other people comfortable. And I don't buy into the perception of, you know, this and that being rude. You know, I think that is a traditional parenting expectation. I think that's quite a neurotypical expectation. I don't believe you should go around calling people names and being obviously mean, but I do have a new understanding and appreciation for different types of communication styles, and that for some people they are just direct and blunt and to the point. That's just the way that their brain is designed, and I don't feel like we should constantly be having to obsess over whether our communication is pleasing other people or making other people comfortable and ticking a box of being polite. I just don't buy into that now. And I don't force that with my children. Okay, sometimes I say, oh, you know, can you get that please, Mum? You know, can you do, thank you. And I'll sometimes obviously, you know, I'll do that, but I don't pull them up every time. And I don't, you know, if they're quite barky, which they've learned from me, to be fair, I don't shame them for it. I used to shame them for it, just as I was probably shamed for it as well. But I don't do that anymore because I realise that is just their natural communication style. And then so some people might say, well, hang on a minute, are you setting them up for the real world and da-da-da-da-da? And well, look, you know, what is the real world? The real world, again, is not one single box, is it? It's not one size fits all. And I don't believe that there is one template of how a human should develop and should operate. I don't believe that. And I do think the world is shifting a bit, thankfully. And I do believe that there will be more acceptance and compassion for differences, right? This is the thing. And this is the thing that kind of, it slightly frustrates me about these assessments. You know, they're very out of date. They're very old fashioned. They're very deficit and disorder based. And I just don't buy that. I very strongly disagree with that language. There is nothing wrong with autistic people. There is nothing wrong with ADHD people. You know, it's like, how have we got into a place culturally where we believe that there's one elite version of human and everyone else is slightly disordered? Rubbish. I like to think of I'd like to think of humans as different colours of crayons in a box. You know, autism's blue, neurotypical's green, ADHD is yellow, dyspraxia is pink. I mean, you know, we're all just slightly different. Okay, there's all these labels. I actually hope that one day we remove all the labels and we just become open-minded about the fact that we are all different and we all have strengths in areas and we all have situations and environments that we thrive and that we don't thrive in. And that we just take ownership for that and that we just feel confident about that and that it's not a label and it's not a thing. At the moment, we need the labels, I think, because it helps the rest of the world understand that, you know, we can't be treated with the one template because that doesn't fit. We don't fit in the one template. And that's where I think labels are helpful right now. But I genuinely hope that those labels don't exist in however many years' time. 100 years is too long, 10 years is probably too soon, right? But at some point in our future, I hope that we just learn to appreciate, love, understand, and have compassion for all of these different brain types, if you like, all of the different ways that we're wired. Because we all have things to offer that are great. You know, I'm ADHD, and you know, I think, and my children are ADHD, I feel lucky that we're in this position because we have so many strengths. Yeah, okay, there's things that we find challenging. Of course there are. There are situations that are definitely harder sometimes, like my daughter going into school this morning. She doesn't like change. She's afraid of new situations. She's anxious of new people. She likes her home comforts. She's very clingy with Mum, who's her main co-regulator. And the thought of being away from Mum for several hours is terrifying for her in a new school with a new uniform that probably feels weird. And, you know, new food and everything is new. That's challenging for my daughter, who's 4.5. You know, that's really challenging. But she's also wonderful at playing on her own. She's so creative and she's tuned into her own world. And I love that about her. I'm so happy that she has an inner spark for things that she feels passionate about. And she doesn't need lots of friends, and you know, she's a very bright, content, happy, sunny, singy girl. You know, lots of things that you wouldn't associate with autism, because most of our autism assessments and research are based on, you know, 8-year-old boys in the 1960s of a certain ethnicity. So, you know, that there isn't the same presentations in all autistic children, right? Or all autistic people, but certainly there are definite differences between boys and girls. And she's not obsessed with trains, and, you know, sitting in a corner with the trains. And again, I'm not saying that boys only present in that way, but that's the type of kind of behavior, if you like, in inverted commas, that we've grown used to associating with things like autism, which is just out of date and plainly wrong. It's wrong. So, yeah, so for me, I think the journey of understanding, I started to recognize in this process of being diagnosed ADHD that not everything fit. There were a lot of things that I felt were more autistic traits. And as I grew my understanding, because I was learning about it at a ferocious breakneck speed, which is what I do, I was bringing this to the table and telling my assessor what I felt like, you know, I was finding and what was resonating with me. She wasn't able to do that diagnosis for me, which is fine, but I did do a pre-assessment for autism, because when you pay privately, it's obviously very expensive, and it is such a shame that so much of this is inaccessible for people at the moment, and that people are waiting for year, 2-3 years before they get seen and assessed. It's tragic that we're in this situation. There are so many people that would benefit from knowing. There are so many people that need help and need support, especially in schools, and it's just not accessible. And I find that very heartbreaking, to be honest. So that's why actually self-diagnosis is a very valid thing. You know, if you have an inkling that you could be neurodivergent, trust that inkling. That's what I would say. Trust that inkling. And I was someone that really felt in the beginning like I needed the validation of an official assessment. But, you know, now I have learned what I've learned. I feel like I didn't need that really. I know I needed it at the time. And I do try to encourage people that can't access assessments to try and lean into the content that's available in the books and the podcasts, and to just get comfortable with identifying a certain way, even if there are naysayers or you're not getting validated by people around you. And that was the thing with me. So I did the pre-assessment for autism, and it came back that it scored highly likely that I would be autistic. And the pre-assessment is something that was, it was a lot cheaper. It was a few hundred pounds. The main autism assessment was over 2,000. And I didn't have the money to do that, because I'd also just paid for my ADHD assessment and was also paying towards my daughter's assessment. So, it very quickly gets quite uncontrollable, the costs. But I took enough reassurance from the pre-assessment coming back as a highly likely, and I just decided to get comfortable with identifying as autistic as well, because I was starting to recognize my autistic side more and more. And I was starting to be able to differentiate between the two, if you like, the conflicting neurotype, which is, you know, the push-pull, the in-out, up-down, the conflict, the feeling of, you know, going left and going right at the same time. Like, that's it. That's what ADHD can feel like. You know, you thrive on spontaneity and you want excitement and you need high dopamine, but you also crave structure. You also need routine. You also need things to be just so in their place. You know, another example of ADHD, which makes me laugh if I see it on social media, is, you know, my house is often show home kind of spotless. I wouldn't say, like, not saying clean, but in terms of tidy, it's always very tidy. Everything's always in its place. I know when something's slightly out of place, it's very ordered. But there are some drawers in the house or some bowls in the house which are just utter chaos. You open the drawer and everything is literally lurching out at you. It's like, that is a physical representation of ADHD right there. Perfectly tidy house, open a few drawers and they're just carnage. But when I decided that I was going to start sharing about the autism side, actually it was interesting because some of the people around me were very kind of like, no, there's no way autistic. You know, they definitely saw the ADHD, but they couldn't see the autism. And so I started to become really aware of masking. And that's something I was noticing alongside my daughter, this whole thing where school felt like she was a certain kind of way. And at home, she was a completely different person. I mean, the two people were just not, you know, they just weren't, they weren't connected. And that's when masking came into focus and how much autistic or ADHD or ADHD children, you know, how much they learn to mask. They have to mask to survive. They have to keep, you know, they have to look like they're coping when actually inside everything is falling apart every single day. And that's what happened with my daughter. That's what pushed her into her burnout, because she couldn't, she just couldn't cope anymore with the toll that the masking was taking. And it made me think about my own life, you know, as an undiagnosed ADHDer, about when I was in school and when I had difficulties in friendships or challenges at secondary school, you know, problems in jobs, or, you know, it just, it helped me to reevaluate my experience of life. And it actually created a lot of sadness. I felt there was a grieving that came with realizing that I'd navigated life for 46 years as an undiagnosed autistic ADHDer. Because you feel like, you know, although I would never change what happened in my life, because I genuinely think that I wouldn't be where I am today had I not been through everything I'd been through, there is that sadness that, well, God, things could have been quite different, you know, or maybe some things didn't need to be as hard as they were, or I don't know, maybe I think it's more about the relationship that I had with myself that was so damaged. You know, I think there's a stat that around something like with ADHDers, I think by the time you get to 18, you've experienced something like 20,000 more bits of criticism than, say, a neurotypical person, that you just had to get used to, you just had to learn to cope with or to absorb. And also, you know, knowing about the neurotype ADHD, there is part of ADHD is something called RSD, which is rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And that is a high sensitivity to criticism and thinking that everyone's against you or worrying that you're just going to lose everything or having abandonment issue. You know, that's a real thing. You know, RSD, I see RSD all the time in my children and I felt it in myself. You know, I was that person that, you know, my boss would say, Terry, can we have a chat? And I'd literally be going into the chat thinking, that's it, they fired me out, I'm sacked, they're going to sack me. They might have been giving me a pay rise, but I convinced myself that I was going to get sacked and that I'd been caught out somehow. And, you know, that's difficult to live with, especially when you don't understand it. You just don't understand why your brain's working in this way, why you're overthinking, why you're dealing with anxiety about the, you know, all these sorts of things. And it plays out in relationships, or it plays out in jobs. And, you know, just not having that support, I think, you know, at the end of the day, autism, ADHD, PDA, all those sorts of things that are under the neurodivergent umbrella, they are hidden disabilities. You know, there is cognitive dysfunction with these neurotypes. And so it's just, yeah, it when you reflect on it, It definitely brings some sadness, and it you know, you can't help but think, wow, what would my life have been like, you know, had I had a parent like myself, right? So, you know, I think that fuels the fire in me to make sure that my children don't have the same experience, that they do feel advocated for, that they do feel accepted for who they are, that it's okay that they don't like social situations. It's okay that my four-year-old doesn't want to go to birthday parties. She doesn't need to learn to how to socialize, despite the fact that the one template of life tells you that you know, in order to grow up as a well-rounded human being, you need to learn all these things. She doesn't need to learn those things. What she needs to do is she needs to learn her own tolerance for life and for environments and for people and for things. She needs to learn that her own internal inside light is the thing that's shining and that's what matters. She needs to know that she has the autonomy to decide what's right and what's not, so that she doesn't grow up like I grew up, which was having a completely broken dial at, you know, 18, 19, 20, and not being able to read situations and not knowing how to protect myself and not knowing what was good for me and what wasn't good for me, because I'd spent my life trying to fit into boxes that weren't made for me. That's how I don't want my children to have to go through that. You know, I want them to be able to advocate for themselves. So if they say, I don't want to do that thing, mommy, I say, fine, that's okay. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you don't want to do that thing. I don't make it mean more than it is. I don't make it mean she won't grow up and have a decent job and good friends when she's 25. I don't make anything mean any of that. I take those thoughts off the table. And that's the thing with my eldest about this journey that we're in at the moment. I've actually deregistered her from school because I know she's not going to cope in school. Certainly not yet, right? Maybe there'll be a time when she does, and great, we can re-register her. And if she chooses, we'll go and do that. But right now she just won't. And there's just no point forcing it. No point making her feel uncomfortable and in distress and undoing all of our hard work. And so, you know, I think that there is a tendency for people, even people in my, you know, my direct family that might think, well, if she doesn't go to school, how is she going to grow up into a decent human being? How is she going to get a good job? How is she going to navigate the world? And I read a brilliant quote in a book. And this quote was, you need to parent for today, not for 10 years' time. Parent, meet them where they're at today. Because no one can predict the future, right? And also, hey, guess what? I have faith that she will find her way. My eldest child, all my children are bright little humans. Like that they, you know, they all have their interests and their passions and their desires, and they all have things they don't like. And I believe in their humanness, that they're here for a reason and that they will find their way and that they will gravitate to the things that they like and they will show interest and then they will explore those things when the time is right. Like I have an instinct for that. I don't think that just because one of my children can't cope in school, that's it, she's, you know, going to have a life of destitution and she's not going to do anything. I don't make those connections. They are false connections, and they are unhealthy connections to make in my parenting journey today when I have to parent my child for where she is today. So I have a lot of confidence in that. And actually moving to that place of acceptance has been incredibly freeing. I cannot tell you how freeing it is to just take school off the table, to take learning off the table. To be honest, she's learning all the time. You know, Dr. Noemi Fisher, who is amazing in this field, she's a psychiatrist and she has neurodivergent children and she's written books and has wonderful courses online. And she works a lot with another lady called Eliza Fricker, who also has great books and really wonderful illustrations, actually, about this, you know, about all this stuff, and all very healing, healing content, to be honest. But you know, she talks a lot about how you learn in different ways, and that even being on YouTube or doing gaming, you know, learning looks different for different children. And, you know, my daughter surprises me with some of the facts that she learns. She's gained some incredible facts through learning things on YouTube and TV and films and things like that, and just exploring things on ChatGPT. I mean, yeah, technology is a big part of her life, but technology will be a big part of her life. So it's not something I heavily police. You know, we talk regularly about online safety. She doesn't have access to social media. She's nearly 12. She probably won't have social media until she's 15, 16. But, you know, everything else is kind of okay. Well, obviously within reason, but you get my point. So there is an element of trust there, and I do trust her, and we do have these conversations. So I feel confident that for her having access to technology, and when she decides she wants to learn something, and, you know, that she'll come to me and we'll get started on things. So that's been very freeing for us as a family, as well as implementing low demand, which is basically we just take the demands away. We don't try to control our children anymore, and we don't force them to be compliant, because, you know, if you're a parent of neurodivergent children, you get that's a painful way to live, you know, forcing sitting at the table, forcing pleases and thank yous, forcing eye contact, forcing all this sort of stuff that society deems as polite and well-rounded. It's just not, it just doesn't work in our family, and that might encourage judgment. But, you know, when you've walked a mile in my shoes, you might feel differently, and you might do things differently. And for us, we've got some harmony in the house now. And that is worth everything when you have, you know, a house with five people in it, you know, with, you know, my eldest is probably hitting puberty, my middle child will be not far off that, I'm in perimenopause, there's a lot of things that are happening in our home. So if there are opportunities to create balance and space and peace and encourage harmony, I am 100% going to take that on board. So anyway, my middle child, she also was diagnosed by the same psychiatrist as my eldest, got her PDA, ADHD. My middle child was also diagnosed autistic, ADHD and PDA. And then my youngest has not been diagnosed because she's only 4.5, and I don't think that they start the assessments in a lot of cases until they start school. So that's something we can maybe pursue now that she's started school, her school journey. But I know enough to know that she's definitely autistic. But I do think that there is ADHD. It's highly likely that there is ADHD. Another quote that I always sticks in my mind is that ADHD runs in families like brown hair. And I thought, yes. And that then took me on a bit of a journey of thinking, well, if I'm autistic ADHD and potentially PDA, right, because we're noticing that there might be some PDA with my youngest, which means that there's basically all ADHD and PDA across the board with all my children. And the common denominator with my children is me as their mother. But I started to realize, oh my God, my dad was ADHD. You know, I was able to, once I'd really learn about the different characteristics and traits, if you like, I recognize them in my dad. I mean, I won't bore you with all the ins and outs, but I very, very, very much see both autism and ADHD with my dad. And then I noticed it with my brother, and then my other brother, and then my mum, you know, who I think I'd often felt like she'd had perhaps undiagnosed mental health issues, because she definitely struggled a lot. She was a very young mum. She had me at 19, and she struggled with parenting a lot. And we had quite a fractured relationship, and we were estranged for the last sort of 10, 15 years of her life. But then having this new lens to look through myself and you know, was looking through my children and then my dad, I was like, oh, right, yeah, okay. Mum was autistic ADHD and PDA. I can see the PDA in my mum. You know, my mum would get into quite a lot of complicated situations. And it's really clear to me now when I look back, a lot of those situations were when she had loss of autonomy. And I think she, yeah, really, really would have struggled with that. And then when I think about her mum, so my grandmother, who I also was estranged from for the last 15 years or so of her life, she would struggle a lot. She would have to go and take regular breaks in the bedroom and like have a lot of time out. And obviously understanding autism and that need for just taking the stimulation away and the sensory overwhelm, I just thought, right, okay. So you just start to connect the dots, I think. So I started to see patterns in my family. And that has all been coming to light for me in the last kind of 12 months or so. So it's a lot, you know, and just on a personal level, you know, managing ADHD, knowing about it has been life-changing, I have to say, but it's helped me to identify that I'm much more aware of when I'm coping and when I'm not coping. And I'm much more aware of how much I've masked for a lot of my life. You know, I don't recognize the person I was even 2 years ago, even some of me a year ago, but certainly 5-10 years ago, like it's like a different person. I'm just not the same. I feel much more at home in myself now, and I like my own company a lot. And I'm a lot of my old friends would say that I'm quite mad, like, you know, quite outgoing, quite, you know, well, I definitely as a drinker, I was quite wild and over the top and very extroverted, but I'm actually really introverted. And I do get quite burnt out when I spend lots of time with people. I'm okay with my husband. And my husband has also identified that he's also autistic. So, I think neurodivergent attracts neurodivergent, put it that way. So I do believe that now. And when I look, you know, to previous partners, I think I can see sprinkling of neurodivergence in a lot of my previous relationships. But, you know, we work very well together, but I have to be careful about how much I book in for myself. I have to be careful about how much I commit. I'm very prone to burnout because I take on too much. I do too much. And, you know, it's like a constant accelerating and braking, which is, you know, can be quite exhausting, to be honest. And, you know, one of the things that I think I've identified as well is that I get very overstimulated having neurodivergent children. Like it really triggers a lot in me, probably because when I was young, I wasn't allowed my feelings, because I think my generation and, you know, a lot of us will relate to, even now, actually, I'll see, you know, you'll see someone crying. It's like, stop crying. You know, we shut down kids' emotions. Like I've done it with my own children when I didn't know any better. And we feel uncomfortable with people's emotions, especially children's emotions. So, because they're usually quite big. So we shut them down, and we get used to the fact that we also, you know, we were shut down when we were kids. So I think that when our children, our neurodivergent children, are having meltdowns or they're expressing their distress, or they're feeling rage, it can be very triggering, because on the one hand, it's sensory overwhelm for me to hit that, the noise, the escalating nervous systems, we're all tuned into each other. So if one's not feeling great, we're all going to be picking up on that. We're quite hypersensitive, especially as ADHDers, but, you know, and with funnily enough, autistic with empathy and stuff like that. So it's, you know, we're quite emotionally tuned into each other. So like, I find it very overwhelming when a child is having a meltdown because it spikes something in me on a nervous system level. But then on top of that, there's also the fact that it triggers something in me because I probably wasn't allowed it when I was younger and it was shut down in me. And so holding space for my child to have that meltdown, I'm also having to learn how to hold space for little me who wasn't allowed to explode. And that's all quite complicated. If I can say anything, that has been like parenting and parenting as a neurodivergent of neurodivergent children. It is the most difficult thing I have ever had to learn or that I'm learning. It's the most difficult thing. And I often make mistakes and then, you know, I feel shame. And then it's just, you know, it's a horrible cycle. The RSD kicks in and I'm a horrible parent and all that stuff. But I always try to repair. I always try to repair. So if I actually lose my shit when one of my children are losing their shit, I will always say, I'm really sorry. Like, I didn't act in a way that, you know, I wanted to. I didn't want to do that, or I love you and it's not your fault. It's me. I feel overwhelmed. And, you know, I try to have a conversation. So I try to repair, and I do feel like that, you know, it doesn't erase the moments when we don't get it right, but it certainly provides some healing and allows the child to detach from being the cause. So they don't grow up feeling like the reason, like they're the problem. Actually, I own the fact that I have the problem. It's my problem, not them. And so I think that goes a long way. And so that's been a really big part of my journey. It's been a really big part of the last 12 months. It's been a really big part of my healing. It's been a really big part of my spiritual awakening. I do think a lot of this triggered the awakening in me. And I do believe that it needed to happen. And I do believe that it was pre-planned and that this was all designed and that I designed this, or that we as a family designed this. We all have our reasons to be here. We all have our lessons. We all have our soul purpose. And even sharing this information, somebody might hear this and find it healing. And it might kickstart something in them that then has a ripple effect in their children or family or friends. And then that, you know, it's almost a bit like the butterfly effect, isn't it? So yeah, thank you so much for listening to me today. I hope that you found it useful. I hope that you found it insightful. I've done my best to convey the complexities of ADHD and how it's impacted my life, my family, my parenting, and myself. And I guess if I was to leave you with anything, the question for reflection that I would leave you with, that I would encourage you to think about, is where in your life are you masking? Where in your life do you feel like you're masking? And paying attention to what comes up with that question, and whatever comes up is potentially something to explore and to look further into and to deep dive, to get more accustomed with who you are and your inside light. So until next week, I don't know what I'm recording next week. I'm in ADHD style. I'll just kind of think about it in the week and I'll come to next week's recording with hopefully an interesting and insightful episode. And until then, have a lovely week.